Okay, so welcome back. I think I'll just wind this thing up in the next 10 or 12 minutes and then we can vote open. The note I stopped on was Omurku's statement that I am consciously advocating a subversive strategy for future political engagement. Current models of political activity are largely beyond reform. Oh, that's a good idea. Okay, let's talk about subversive. Subversive? Why not? The internet is subversive because, of course, it gives the power to the people and does not have any gatekeeper. And so people can communicate freely and widely and say what they want. And there's some kind of interesting graphics I was looking yesterday on the internet to see if I could find any maps or representations of just what was going on, because to my way of thinking, this noosphere thing that Chardin is pointing to, where self-awareness grows. If you look at the Earth as a living organism, you can think of the channels of communication that are sprouting out everywhere on the internet as being kind of like nerve synapses in a big brain rolling through space at 18 and a half miles a second. That's how fast the Earth is rotating around the sun. Worldwide coverage of the internet back in 1996 was represented this way, just by showing you what places had coverage. And the purple ones, of course, did. And then the other ones had different types of connections. The green could do email. There was the yellow that had no connectivity at all. And then there's more modern representation. This is a kind of a schematic of the heavy-duty trunk lines, if you will, that carry data across the globe. Maybe a little dark.
I need to explain what's where there. It's hard to see.
Yeah, it is hard to see. Well, I'll show you another one that may be a little less... Is that a little better? Yeah.
A lot better.
All right, that gives you another sense of where the lines are. This happens to be optical fiber submarine systems. Optical fibers carry huge amounts of data, you know. And so... Very extensive networks are going all over the world to enable communications to take place. And the internet also uses a number of satellites that are in geostationary orbit. Each satellite can see this much. So you can beam up and beam down very quickly data. And those satellites are sitting above the equator, rotating at the speed of the Earth, and providing a more or less continuous connectivity for the planet. Still, and this is another one, that's an interesting one, that shows you just a kind of a three-dimensional map of who's talking to whom on the internet. And it doesn't include very much of Africa, does it? You know? And China seems a bit dark in this representation, too. Let's look at that. There's one more that I've got. This is two different schematics that show you on the top one the density of internet traffic presently in the world in terms of what's called router density, where the signals are being generated and transmitted mostly. And as you can see, America and North America and Europe are big time into the internet, although over in the Far East you've got the major cities on the fringe of Australia well connected, and then you've also got Japan and coastal portions of China that are very, very intensely busy with traffic. Same is true around India and the Gulf states, where they have money and they can afford to do this. On the other hand, If you look at this map that shows you the current population density and the way it's spread around the world, you see that areas of intense population, like the Asian and South Asian subcontinents, are not necessarily well represented on the corresponding map in terms of internet activity. That's especially true in Africa, where you have huge populations but very sketchy infrastructure. Doesn't mean it won't get better, but it means that there's a kind of a growing pain going on. Interesting also how dense the population is in South America, in Central America, and still the internet connections only kind of touch the major cities on the coast.
But Tom,
yeah.
That doesn't reflect the wireless system, does it?
No, this is just regular internet.
Because, well, you can get the internet wireless, can't you?
Yeah, you can, but the way...
That's why it's so important in the third world countries that they're emphasizing the wireless techniques, because they're not bothered with the microfibers.
Yeah. Well, that may be true. The problem is that most of us, when we talk wireless, we're talking about having a Wi-Fi card in our computer that can talk a distance of 400 feet, maybe, on a good day, to a base station that is connected to the internet, you see. That is not the same technology as cell phones, but even they have to talk to nearby stations, and if you, you know, go take a hike in the back country here, you'll find how quickly your cell phone is useless. And so if you're thinking that wireless means I can talk to a satellite from Earth, we're not yet there for most people. Most people don't have satellite phones, let alone satellite connected computers.
Yeah, they don't have the hardware.
Yeah. But anyway, and also this is another map that shows you basically the size of the connection between the different nodes shows you how much traffic is going on right now. And there's this huge transfer between Europe and the U.S. and Canada, and then a very big one between the U.S. and Asia. And then it gets smaller and smaller as you go to the other major continents. There are many subversive websites on the internet today too, and Alice mentioned that I had mounted one at the Holy Land Protectorate, well, about the idea of a Holy Land Protectorate that would basically take the, it turns Mideast policy on its head, revisiting how we govern Antarctica, and that's an example of a whole continent which has no nation state or nation state claim, and still works. And suggesting that you could use that non-sovereign state status in other parts of the world as well. Just takes a little bit of willpower. It's called turning the Earth upside down. And that is Antarctica up there. And this is the Holy Land down here. And that's the Suez Canal and Sinai Desert, so on. So there are many, many subversive websites on the internet today, and one of my favorite clearinghouses for these is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's site called thewagingpeace.org, and it has, the Council for a Livable World, Four Mother Earth International, Global Security Institute, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the Arms Control Association. There's an awful lot of people working, you know, in these areas. The International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the Nuclear Control Institute, Nuclear Files, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Western States Legal Foundation, War and Peace. There are associations, and all of them have these internet sites. And so what's going on here is, of course, the world is organizing itself in interest groups that are going to become basically pressure groups. Bread for the World, the example we had just at the start of this presentation. A terrific organization. And it's, the letter writing campaigns our political action that really counts. And so, more power to you, I say. Pax Christi is one of my favorites. This little thing down here. More peace in war sites. It seems just to go on and on. The Union of Concerned Scientists. Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Golly, Plowshares is up there. That's a group that, if I'm not mistaken, the Berrigans were active in at one time. Yeah. And then it goes, you can go on, international law sites, you know, the World Federations and such. And then groups that are concerned about nuclear waste and energy, Nuclear Control Institute, all these different things having to do with, this is a sign of hope, I think. So I'll leave you, I think, with some food for thought, which I think is kind of nice. There was a couple of days ago, I get this little thing called Verse and Voice. It's one passage of scripture and one quotation every day from the Sojourner website. And this one crossed my desk just a couple of days ago. It's from Oscar Arias, the Nobel Prize winner in 1987. He said, "Peace is a never-ending process, the work of many decisions by many people in many countries. It is an attitude, a way of life, a way of solving problems and resolving conflicts. It cannot be forced on the smallest nation, as we know, or enforced by the largest. It cannot ignore our differences or overlook our common interests. It requires us to work and live together." Here's another bit of wisdom. This is from an essay by Garrison Keillor that came out in Time magazine in 2003. This was just when California had elected Schwarzenegger as governor. And he's the guy from Minnesota where they had Jesse Ventura, the wrestler, had become governor. And so he was writing this thing. And he's kind of telling us in California what he thought of all this. He says, "After 4 years of an action hero governor, it is a relief to go back to politics as usual, where soft-spoken people with ordinary chest sizes sit down and do the work." Politics isn't a story. He's using this process word. It's a process. It's not about confrontation and threat and revenge and triumph. Is mostly about civility. Most men and women in politics are there because they genuinely like people and want to do good things on their behalf. It is hard work, and fury isn't the best motivation. We could use a little less fury in the White House these days, I think. You have to sit through the meetings, listen to other people, and be civil about it. What an idea. Anger and loathing are losing hands in politics. You go for a walk on a summer night and notice the little ramps carved into curves on street corners. People sat through a lot of meetings to get that accomplished. It was a boon to the wheelchair crowd and also to parents pushing strollers and kids riding bikes. It made life slightly more civil and friendly. Government works through small, incremental changes. And, do you want to hear a little bit of Jim Wallace?
Oh, yeah.
He's great, I'll tell you. This is just a little essay that he sent yesterday that arrived. And he says, "If it's not good news, it's not evangelical." Isn't that wonderful? I mean, it's just a great little essay. He's always doing this. "I was at Bethel University in the Twin Cities on Tuesday, known as a conservative evangelical school in Minnesota, and located in the heartland of the American Midwest. Bethel has long been regarded as a safe and secure place for conservative Republican politics, even as a fertile ground for recruiting by the religious right. And in the last two elections, most Bethel students certainly would have voted for George W. Bush. But the wind is changing at Bethel. It is as it is among a new generation of evangelical students across the country. Yesterday was a dramatic demonstration of that change, one that will be most significant for both faith and politics in America. I started my day at Bethel by speaking in chapel and asking a new generation to clear up the confusion in this nation about what it means to follow Jesus. I asked them if they wanted to be true evangelicals, defining the root meaning of that word evangel, which literally means good news. The word was first used by Jesus in his opening statement in Nazareth, recorded in Luke 4, when he defined his own mission by saying, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news, the evangel, to the poor." I told the young evangelical audience that any gospel that wasn't good news to the poor simply wasn't the gospel of Jesus Christ. It was clear from the reception, from the response in this chapel, that a new generation of evangelical Christians want to be, like Jesus, good news to the poor. And because of that, their agenda is now much broader and deeper than just the two things the religious right continues to talk about as the only moral values issues, abortion and gay marriage. The Bethel students, like me, still believe that the sanctity of life and healthy family values are indeed important issues. In fact, they are too important to be turned into political wedge issues to get votes at election time. We need a deeper moral discussion of both those questions than we find occurring in the political arena today. But there are clearly no longer just two moral values issues for this evangelical generation. They care deeply about poverty, global warming, sex trafficking, human rights, genocide in Darfur, and the ethics of war in Iraq. And they are eager for an agenda that will call forth their best gifts, energies, and the commitment of their lives. This generation won't accept the narrowing of Scripture to only two hot-button social issues, and have found those 2,000 verses in the Bible that speak of God's concern for the poor and vulnerable. For them, environmental concern is creation care. I like that. That links us way back to our roots, you know, creation care. And they want a consistent ethic of life that addresses all the places where human life and dignity is threatened, not just one. That doesn't mean that their votes, which conservative Republicans have taken for granted, will now automatically go to liberal Democrats. Instead, they are eager to challenge the selective moralities of both left and right in response to a moral agenda for politics that will hold both sides accountable. In the future, any candidate from either party who speaks the moral language of politics and lifts up the issues of social justice the Bible talks so much about could attract the attention of this new generation. The chapel was packed. Every seat in the house was taken. I told them the faith is for the big stuff, that politics was failing to solve our deepest crises, and that it was time for faith-inspired movements to change both politics and history, as we have done many times before, invoking the abolition of slavery and the civil rights movement, among others. When the students rose to their feet at the end, it didn't just feel like a standing ovation, but rather an altar call for students standing to say that they want their faith in their lives to make a difference in our world. Well, that's my presentation, folks. Thank you. Okay, I'll be happy to entertain comments and whatever.
Tom?
What's your pleasure? Yeah.
I would just like to quote what Richard Rohr said in one of his books, "The State of Religion Today is Halfway Between Fundamental Silliness and Secular Arrogance."
Oh, that's great. Richard Rohr, huh?
Yeah.
Good. And his website is called, the Center for Action and Contemplation.
Yeah.
He gets both of them in there, which is really wonderful, yeah. Anybody? Yeah.
Thank just wanted to point out a study that came out published in National Geographic that attempted to trace our roots, our genetic roots, DNA and DNA. And a group of geneticists got together and took thousands, or even in excess of 10,000 samples of blood from around the world, including the most remote areas. And they actually tracked our route to Africa for the entire human family alive now. And which coincides to all people alive now go back at the most 50,000 to 75,000 years.
That's interesting. It's only 50 to 75,000.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they analyzed the DNA of all these ancient souls we found. It's a totally different DNA. Nothing to do with all human DNA right now.
So what you're talking about then is that little corner of that. We're it.
The entire human family alive right now. And they speculate that it coincides with the last ice age. And that they had to leave Africa because when the water withdrew and the desert came, they had to leave for sustainability to other areas. And they came into, they tracked it literally by the DNA and mutations. They tracked the journey of when they left Africa and went around the world.
Yeah.
And they think that all the earth didn't survive the climate change. Or was probably exterminated by these people. They were more involved. Because they had discovered language and etc.
Yeah.
So anyway, that pokes another hole a little bit in the emergent theory.
Yeah.
And the ultimately, they think that patriarchy is just a manifestation of something we are born with, the dark side. And the agricultural revolution was only a trigger point. If it hadn't been that, it would have been something else. It was basically survival.
Mm, yes.
And that now we have evolved where patriarchy just has no need for it. It has outlived its purpose, and we are ready for the next step.
That's a good point. Thanks for making those comments, and that gives us a lot to think about. Also, I think by limiting our concept of the meaning of humans to the last 70,000 years or whatever, I find that useful because I guess I could be called a humanist. I'm rather fond of our species, and you know, I don't want it to come to destruction and difficulty and sadness and grief and everything. Mm. Other comments? Oh, look, way back in the back, yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say that one thing that I really admired about the people in Minnesota when Jesse Van Til was running was the fact that they said, we have had it with the state law. And yes, he wasn't the greatest governor, but my gosh, he was willing to give it a shot. And they were so willing to let it. They didn't work, but my gosh, they stepped out in front and did something different. And so, you know, I think that's what he knows. Also, I got an information last night that the largest telephone company in Spain is working really hard to get Brazil and some of the other South American countries up to speed. They're probably never going to be able to light landlines, for instance, through the Amazon, but they are working very hard to try to bring them along.
Yeah. Well, that's good news. Interesting. Thank you. Any other?
I think that the Time article on Barack Obama, I've been studying it and kind of reflecting on his and listening to him, and he's kind of embodied so much this kind of refusal to be part of the dualism that is currently there, and comes from such a unique, he had the Gita and the Quran and the Bible all on his shelf as growing up, you know. So I think it's kind of like a new kind of brain thinking about what's going on in politics reflected in his, at least his words and that article.
Yeah, he's a hopeful sign. Kind of the way Jim Wallace and Richard Rohr do. Anyone else?
My husband and I are in a wonderful group you've heard about called Just Faith. And in a nutshell, we're addressing the issue of poverty. And a lot of the time is spent with discussions among the 12 members of the group. And we're all on the same page. But partisan politics raises its ugly head, or is about to. It hasn't happened yet. We're all kind of nervous about this. What is your advice how to have a academic yet practical discussion without making the discussion partisan? And is it possible? I think what this war has done is make the politics be right on the surface of everything. And we're all maybe too partisan these days. I'm not sure how to address issues without being partisan.
Yeah, and I think maybe your question could be better answered by our collective wisdom here than by me. But I think I would just reflect that, you know, if you take the meaning of just faith as only faith, leave politics out of it, you've got it wrong, because it's just faith. It's the justice part that really counts. I think that we had a presentation here at Word and Life, the Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministry.
Chad Myers.
He had something to say about this issue. If it involves money, which often it does, that money and politics tend to kind of sleep in the same bed sometimes. And so what he was talking about is a gospel way to be the steward of your resources. And maybe approaching it that way, would avoid having to hit the politics on the head if it became more a question of stewardship of resources. And we'll all do what we can. And maybe we'll have a speaker come in who could talk to us about ethical investing and things like, good strategies, for instance, for helping the poor. What I heard of recently was those of us who might have, say, a portfolio of stocks would find in that portfolio certain ones which have appreciated a great deal. And if you just went and sold it to convert it to cash, you would end up having to pay quite a bit of
capital
gains. But if you donate the appreciated stock, you don't have to. They get it all. So it's just a simple strategy like that. Word and Life. This is another thing that Ann just gave to me. Page 19 of the Word and Life brochure has ground rules for personal and communal deep dialogue. And those are pretty good, I think. So that could be a help, too. Yeah, thanks. Mary?
I think what I really liked about this chapter in Omar Kulin generally the book is his way of thinking much larger. So that when he talks about politics, he doesn't say Democrats good, Republicans bad. It's way kind of taking a different stance entirely, getting like outside of the whole system that we're so bound up in, especially right now. So when he talks even about religion and politics as bifurcated, he really, what we see from it right now today is a religious right, kind of as the religious part of it. But he, again, for me, kind of steps outside of that current paradigm and looks at what what we need to be thinking about. We need to broaden. We need to look contemplative, as you said. We need to dialogue. We need to take into account our moral and religious traditions. These are all things that you see that I think we could agree with.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
It's so hard to get out of our current place. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do that. And that's why I really, really appreciated his answer.
I noticed that in the evening that'll move over to spoke at the Friars Lounge. He said rather softly and parenthetically that retrieval, looking to the past for what was good, is not regression. And I wish that somebody in the audience had picked up on that. It made me wonder if Omerku is sort of rethinking some of his thoughts that were published in this book, which do give the impression that he felt that things in the past have been glorious and cooperative, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But
I wouldn't put it past him to be on a journey, sure.
I did get the feeling that in his own mind, he is rethinking and evolving his own thinking. I cut him a lot of slack because I think he's so brave.
I mean, in this book, he doesn't say it was all glory back there. He says we have violence and competition, but the only way we got here, primarily to survival, came through the cooperative interaction from small cell on up. Not that we haven't had competition. In fact, that's, I think, his point. It's not, and when he's talking about going back, he's talking about retrieving a part of ourselves that we've been cut off from, and that's our whole connection, interconnectedness with nature that was a part of our history in the past. I don't hear him. And you know, another thing, sort of in his defense, he would say he's not a scientist, he's not a theologian, he's a social psychologist, and so he wouldn't at all, I don't think, object to people taking issue with some of the scientific facts. He's doing a little bit more what Mary's talking about, is trying to look at the broader issues and name them. And, you know, this particular chapter I liked, especially when he talked about the oikonomia.
Yeah.
It made me go back to Michael Crosby's book when he talked about the main metaphor in Matthew's gospel for the community of disciples was the oikia, the house.
Mm-hmm.
And the house being a home and the economy that provided for the needs of all the members of the household. And that, the template for that, is the economy in the Trinity, where everything is honored as for its uniqueness, but everything is shared in common. There's no lack in the Trinity. And that's the template out of which creation has come. So the violence comes when we don't attend to that the equality, the mutuality, the reciprocity that is in the Trinity. I think really that's where Omerku is coming from, and I myself don't want to get too lost in the details that don't resonate on a factual level, because I'm more like Joanna, where I want to give the benefit of the doubt because I know in the larger picture what he's trying to come from. And he even says it in this, that the oikonomia, the politics and the people, are interconnected dimensions of a unified reality. And it's when they're out of balance. And I agree with what Mary was saying about the separation of church and state. And even Richard Rohr gave a talk, the gospel is both mystical and political. mean, you can't talk about the economy of the house that doesn't in some way disturb the inequalities that exist in the house. And so you can't separate it out. It's not, I think Mary, you named it funny that he was talking about what we think of as religion and the state of religion. And the other thing about the incarnation I'd just like to add is K. Hardaker Dan himself would say that incarnation, creation, and redemption are coterminous, that they began at the same time, they co-evolve. And I think there is some sort of private place of the human that we like to think that the incarnation happens in the life of Jesus, I think, which it did. In fact, the complaint against Teilhard was that he did not pay enough attention to the historical Jesus. He was more interested in the cosmic life. And that in kind of Barbara Marks Hubbard touched on this last week, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the whole movement towards creation itself becoming conscious of its own divinity. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in the incarnation of Jesus of Nazareth, with a quantum leap in consciousness, something like that. So I don't think he would discount it, but he's not going to put a private place that disconnects it from the rest of our evolution.
Okay. Christine, did you want to say something? Or?
Well, when we were talking about Jeff Bezos, a number of years ago I discovered Grameen Banking and microcredit and microinvestments.
Yeah.
And it's been kind of a wonderful stealth sort of process that I think is really marvelous. And 2 weeks ago, the founder, Mohammed Yunus, and the Grameen Bank were given the Nobel Peace Prize, which also reflects a shift on the Nobel Peace Committee to say that peace is not just the work of those who are negotiating treaties or promoting disarmament or whatever, but also those who are attacking the root causes of the lack of peace, which would include poverty. So I think that's a very...
That's a really good point, yeah. And a good sign, too. Yeah. Well, that's collective wisdom, yes, Joy.
Well, I would say the whole idea of combining church, state, and economy is vital. And he's not contradicting his idea of separation. Actually, he's showing that each of the three are divided. And really, and you just said it too, I think the economy is probably controlling everything we do today.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's
so
a really good point, yeah.
We need to look at it, but also with regard to words to Joe's saying, this is probably the perfect time to get into a political discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because people are beginning to see beyond a mere political stance of party to what is happening to our whole society.
Mm-hmm.
And with the justice issue, I know the group I belonged to years ago, or a few years ago, once the people actually went to Skid Row, once they had experience with people that were really hurting in some way, they changed everything in their lives, including their looking at politics too narrowly, and they themselves were tested. There is a lot of
them.
This is a good
time
to do it.
I wanted to give
Chase
a chance to say something.
I'd like to hear you comment. Overall, I feel pretty pessimistic. I don't think Teilhard and Elmerchu are being very realistic. I don't see the big, powerful elements, you know, the world, corporations and governments giving up power.
Mm-hmm.
For me, there's always that threat of the remnant. You know, the little group all through Hebrew history and mm-hmm. Jesus and the little flock and the subversive groups, you know, we're talking about, they're great and they're going to go on. I don't feel that optimistic about our human race overall. Could you comment on it?
Oh boy, the wisdom to change what can be changed. yeah. accept what can't be, yeah. and you know, and to know the difference.
How true.
I sure have a difficulty with it. I think we're getting pretty close to time, aren't we?
I have a question.
Okay.
Somebody else should choose. All right. We have 5 minutes.
Okay.
4 minutes.
Right. Yeah, that's the clock that we're using.
No, no,
that one up there.
No,
I think we're supposed to do a song too, so I need
to have a song. Maybe it's a
rap.
Could I just ask you, Tom, when you showed the slide of the man in the room and you talked about politics and men and there was the lady in the back mm-hmm. feeding the baby
yeah.
and the other one serving the men. Did you, I may not have heard this correctly, but did you say something about Muslims?
I said, what I said was that the picture that you have here is basically in a coffee shop. It's like a public house with men sitting around, you know, beating on tables and discussing live, in a lively way what's going on. That picture came from the English tradition, but it could have been replicated in the Muslim world too. If you went to a Muslim coffee house, you would see Muslim men sitting around, you know, discussing things. You wouldn't see women.
Yeah. Well, that, but not, but you're referring to Muslim as a religion.
Well, I think cultural.
Culture.
Okay.
Arabic, I don't know.
But not just Arabic, right? I mean, I just came from Northern Italy, where men
yeah.
around the park table, there were no women.
How about that?
And they were discussing politics. So I guess since peace has a lot to do with attitudes,
yeah.
I just didn't want, you know, this to be an attitude about, quote, Muslims or a stereotypic type.
Oh, no, I point well taken, and I thought that this was almost it's a universal representation.
Very universal.
Yeah, and I just wanted to extend it beyond the confines of England. And you're right, Italy
is not just Muslims.
Yeah.
It'll be a Chinese tea house.
Okay.
Okay.